character. I'm inhabiting the role of me. You know? I'm like Jim Carrey with Andy Kaufman. It's like, Will's not gone. Will's going to be here. Will's going to do this role. So a week or two ago, I went to see this film called Le Camion. Very highbrow French art film from 1977 by Marguerite Duras. Marguerite Duras was, you know, one of many disappointed Marxist intellectuals in France who was very excited by May 1968 and very saddened by the years after. And the film is her and Gerard Depardieu sitting at a table in her house reading the script for this film that will never be made. The script is a road movie about a young, disillusioned Marxist girl, ex-Marxist girl, who's now sort of a nihilist, and a truck driver who's sort of hopeful for the future. And the movie alternates between scenes of Girard and Depardieu reading the script and scenes of a truck driving in the French countryside. Very unscenic, you know, looks like Slough in the UK office. And, you know, this is a movie that, I mean, when I first heard about it, I think John Waters mentioned it in one of his books, very kind of cheekily recommending it as like a movie that raises pretentiousness to an art form. And that was kind of the nicest thing you'd read about a movie like this in the mainstream press for decades. For years, stuff like this was regarded by, you know, many of the polite gatekeepers of our society as like for sickos only. And I saw it with a sold out audience of mostly people younger than us, incredibly enough. Very appreciative, very respectful. And I mean, I felt the movie very strongly. What it was saying about the sort of atmosphere it was capturing of what to do in the midst of political defeat resonated strongly with me. And, you know, much of the idea of that film, much of the formal approach of it is like, well, if there's no hope, what do you do? Why are we telling a story? Is the only option burn it all down? Why don't we burn down the form? Mind you, the movie is beautifully photographed, technically very adroit. So there's a sort of internal tension there that's very interesting. But, you know, I was struck watching it by this tension I've been feeling in the culture of, in film culture at least, mass culture seems kind of worse than it's ever been. You go on Rotten Tomatoes and there's no middle brow anymore, right? There's no like mainstream press. I mean, there's some. There's like the New York Times and a few things like that. But for the most part, if you scroll through the Rotten Tomatoes page of any big blockbuster, it's a lot of sort of influencers who frankly are bought and paid for by movie studios. So like if a blockbuster comes out, the first wave of reviews on Rotten Tomatoes are always these people who get like the free pass to see the movie at the early screening. If it's the worst movie ever made, like The Flash or The Rise of Skywalker, or one, you know, one of those really, really bad ones that's kind of undeniable, you'll see like their 3-star out of 5 reviews that are like, you know, there are some issues, but you know, you can't deny that it's got images on the screen, and you get to hear the Wookiee do the roar.
If France is our reference point for this episode, these people are Vichy.
But then if it's one that's like, you know, better than those, if it's Black Panther or something like that, the reviews will be like revolutionary. It's the first time, first time a movie has ever had images on the screen. 5 million stars out of 5.
15 AI generated thumbs up.
Right, right. And you know, say what you will about Vincent Canby at the New York Times. And I'm not a fan. But it's like, it was a different class of guy. So that's happening. But then, on the other hand, like, cinephilia is better than it's ever been. The guy we're going to talk about on this episode, Robert Bresson, for years, for decades, he was regarded by the polite gatekeepers of, you know, the mainstream press.
In North America and the English-speaking world,
yeah,
I assume.
But,
right?
But even
different reputation,
you know,
in France, probably?
Different reputation in France, but definitely in the English-speaking world, it's like, well, this is for sickos only. Mm-hmm. This is the ultimate in, like, highbrow elitism, and the art house hits were like whatever Harvey Weinstein said they should be, you know, middle brow, like doofus bozo, asshole, you know, asshole criminal in it also. Not only is he a doofus and a bozo, but he's also a criminal. I want to underline that.
Well, it's funny. Will and I are just, as ever, continuing the conversation we were having before we switched the mics on, and he's actually come out of the gate with sort of the optimistic conclusion he found at the end. That is very much not what the trajectory of the conversation was before. Thinking back to it now, we were talking for about 20 minutes before we started working. And we kind of did a sort of reverse Dante. You know, we started in Paradiso and then we just, descended further and further. We started by talking about, things we like and appreciate. I was telling Will about my recent re-immersion in a historian whose work I like and in, the intellectual history of the 20th century.
John Meacham.
Yeah, that's right. Friend of the pod, official house historian of Michael and us. You know, Will was talking about, a series of French art films on or concerned with the post-1968 moment. We then got to talking about Siskel and Ebert.
Can I have a bit of an interlude on Siskel and Ebert?
Yes.
On YouTube right now, somebody has edited together these great compilations of Siskel and Ebert review the films of Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Woody Allen, David Lynch, the big guys who were the big guys when they were reviewing movies. And it's great to watch these compilations because they're primary source documents. You know, you feel like you're going on an adventure through these careers as they're happening. And Siskel and Ebert are the most like middle of the middle guys of the time. For the most part, they're going to tell you, and even if they veer from consensus, they will tell you what the consensus is. Mm-hmm. And so with somebody like, for example, Woody Allen had that run of movies in the 80s, you feel their excitement with each one of these movies. It's like, oh my God, it's Purple Rose of Cairo, Hannah and Her Sisters, Radio Days. Where's he going next? He's getting better and better.
The Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
Yeah, yeah.
Anything else?
With the benefit of hindsight, we know. Or like with Martin Scorsese, it's like, okay, Raging Bull, The King of Comedy, After Hours, and then they're like, oh, The Color of Money. What does this represent? Is this a commercial turn in his career?
Well, they were clearly right about that. Scorsese never made another good film after that.
Yeah, yeah. And, Color of Money, by the way, I just watched it recently.
Yeah, I hear it slaps.
It's fucking awesome. Yeah. It's great. If it was any other director, it'd be their best movie.
He's the man.
Yeah. But that's what's great about these. They are primary source documents.
Well, I would like to do an episode. If anyone's following these, I would love to do an episode just on one of them. I think we could have an interesting discussion that's like, X or Y through the lens of Siskel and Ebert, like mediated by Siskel and Ebert.
I love that.
It'd be really cool. So hit us with your suggestions.
David Lynch, he's playing you like a piano. Well, if he's going to play me like a piano, he better have some music worth listening to. That's what's great about it too. Like the level of insight that they're offering is like so basic.
Anyway, we were talking about Siskel and Ebert. So, we descended to the Purgatorio. Then we found our way to guys that we hate and not guys like Siskel and Ebert or
not guys you've heard
not,
of.
Not capital G guys, small G guys.
Yeah, punching down.
Very small G guys. I don't know. And this turned into a conversation about various, the actual genesis of this was that I was talking about the, late historian Tony Judd and how satisfying his intellectual takedowns in some cases really were. And then we were spitballing like, well, could Will do this for just like, annoying guys that you might see at a film festival who no one's ever heard of. The worst guy who stands up at the beginning of a film festival Q&A. and has the most performative, like, this is more of a comment than a question.
I'll just say that if you look up the Cannes press conference for Killers of the Flower Moon, there's one question that's really good in there.
And that particular film festival guy, he belongs to this universe that you were alluding to earlier, He's a product of the ersatz democratization of, film criticism, which is fake democratization because it's really more, a sycophantic culture where, you get free swag from one of the three conglomerates that owns most of culture now. And all you have to do is never give anything they produce less than 3 stars out of 5.
Yeah, and you know what? Like the old critics, the critics of the old times who wrote for establishment media, they also got free stuff.
Yeah.
But they had editorial oversight.
That's right.
They had codes of conduct that they had to follow.
Whereas this type of guy today, they don't even understand in many cases that they are a fake rank and file that is conscripted by, you know, large entertainment conglomerates to give the appearance of like, oh, look, this is just all these are film appreciators. These are film nerds. They blog on the World Wide Web and they liked our movie. And it's like everything else. It's just designed to create phony grassroots support for something. It's like when a political party or leader holds a rally and then just a bunch of staffers go and like they cheer enthusiastically to every focus grouped applause line. And it's there for the cameras to make it look like there's like a real audience that's turned up.
I have to be fair again. There was a period in the 90s when Harvey Weinstein would just give every newspaper arts section its fucking marching orders. And so like the Cannes Film Festival, 1999, David Cronenberg's Jury, they give the Palme d'Or to an obscure Belgian movie called Rosetta by the Dardenne brothers, a movie that has become a classic. And the Dardenne brothers, over time, have proven themselves worthy of the many Palme d'Ors they've won. But, you know, at the time, you go and look at what Variety was writing, what the New York Times was writing. The headline was, what the fuck is this selection? Like, they ignored every popular movie in competition. They're giving the prizes to these Belgians. Jury prize going to Bruno Dumont. What the fuck is this? Like, how come no American films got any prizes? And, like, Harvey Weinstein was mad. This is perversity on David Cronenberg's part. And the only possible reason Cronenberg could like this movie is because he's jealous of his North American contemporaries, and this is career manipulation. And, you know, as Cronenberg himself has said, I think time has been kind to the jury picks. So, of course, you know, the old guard was very corruptible as well. But I would also say it was still a different era of fool.
Well, there was another guy we were talking about.
yeah, that's him.
and you were saying, and by the way, Will, I do think you should write this book. Like you should write a book that uses certain generations of annoying like film loser guys to illustrate things about the trajectory of film and culture, the good and the bad. But there's an earlier generation of guy who was annoying in a different way. You know, maybe they're constantly replying in an overly familiar way to, you know, on the Twitter feeds of various actors and directors and actresses.
I'm thinking of certain instances right now. Yeah.
Maybe they make a little too much and are a little delusional about like, well, okay, if you go to a film festival and you get 20 minutes with, I don't know, Rian Johnson, and you know, you interview someone on that level who's switched on, they're at a film festival, they want to ingratiate themselves to you because they want to get a good write-up or whatever. They understand what's going on here, but you mistake this for genuine friendship and you think, I'm going to be the guy at one of the four, you know, internationally renowned marquee film festivals. I'm gonna be the guy like this where, you know, afterwards, the person I interviewed is going to be sitting alone in their, you know, beautiful mansion in Beverly Hills, like Jerry Lewis in The King of Comedy, but thinking, wow, that guy was incredible. What penetrating insights. Like, why did you want to make this film? How have you been finding Toronto? Maybe he takes you out for lunch and he says, Rupert, I don't know how you do it. Anyway, annoying type of guy, to be sure, but a different generation of film culture loser. Because, yeah, as you said, Will, maybe once employed at a now defunct, you know, newspaper or magazine or something, like the loserdom is mediated by some kind of institutional structure that maybe gives it more credibility, maybe makes it a little less annoying. There isn't this kind of, yeah, phony democracy of just, oh, I have a blog and I'm just the willing, you know, servant of the Marvel brand. You know, maybe there's an excessive and annoying kind of loyalty and obsequiousness towards, I don't know, individual directors these guys like or something. But it's not a loyalty to brands in the same way. This kind of guy, when they do their write-up, is less likely to use the word franchise in earnest as something that's, you know, as a laudable category that with which they identify.
As I say, on the one hand, there are sold-out audiences of Zoomers going to see Marguerite Duras movies here in town. And then on the other hand, you see the proliferation of all those, like, TikTok clips of people being like, why is every director's favorite movie a four-hour Romanian silent film about poverty? On like film TikTok or whatever, there is still a massive and ever-growing market for sort of anti-intellectualism and lack of curiosity. And those people are on Rotten Tomatoes too. Like that older type of guy, that establishment media loser guy, was also kind of expected to have a basic fundamental understanding of, you know who Howard Howard Hawks is.
Yeah.
You know who Jean-Luc Godard is.
Yeah.
You know who Charlie Chaplin is. You know some of the basic building blocks of the history of the medium that you're covering. And today there are kids, there are Zoomer kids, who are fucking downloading the entire Fassbender filmography in one weekend and watching it, and they're all experts now. And that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And then there are other types of guys who are the exact opposite of that.
You know, I'm not on TikTok, but I brushed up against the sort of millennial YouTube version of this where, you know, periodically, I don't do this that often, periodically Will and I will watch a film for this podcast, maybe an older film, an art film, maybe one I'm super familiar with, but I'll still want to see, you know, has somebody done a good, you know, YouTube essay on it, or just, you know, what are people thinking about this in the present day? And I remember when we did our episode on Persona, finding, I don't know, some channel, probably 7 million subscribers, you know, maybe it wasn't that much, it might have been a million or 800,000. And it's some couple that reviews movies and they watch Persona, and their whole take on it was like, this film has just been built up so, so much. And I mean, I don't know, it didn't really do anything for us. And there's no engagement with, you know, the decades of things that have been written about this film. There's no sense of who Ingmar Bergman is, was. There's no sense that you need to go into this with any kind of basic literacy about the subject. It is a product of, yeah, the age of the take. You watch something, it's ephemeral. Your own relationship to your criticism or to whatever you're producing is ephemeral. There's no sense that something may be grounded in a tradition, whether it's a type of filmmaking or a form of criticism, an approach to criticism. And the result, in my opinion, is just completely worthless, because even if it's, you know, it's fine. If you don't like Persona, that's fine. You got to do some work to explain why you don't like Persona and why decades of people who do like Persona have missed something or are wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot invested in the idea that, like, a person's fresh reaction, you know, fresh, unspoiled, virgin reaction to something is, like, inherently valuable. And you know, maybe 1% of the time it is.
Yeah, but it is really funny, like, you think about the culture of spoiler warnings, which, you know, I guess it makes sense to a degree if something's in theaters right now or something. But you see it, like, I'm pretty sure there was one on this awful YouTube review of Persona where there's a spoiler warning. Why the fuck would you have a spoiler warning for Persona in the 21st century?
Well, look, Luke, we've been having such a lovely conversation. I hate to interrupt it, but we do have a Patreon to promote. Patreon.com/MichaelandUs. For $5 per month, you get an extra episode every week. You can get twice as much of this great content. And what can I tell you? This week, we've got a Patreon episode on the number one movie at the box office right now, Civil War. Folks, is this an eerily prescient view of what America could be?
Subscribe at patreon.com/MichaelandUs to find out.
What is so civil about war, by the way? That's my question.
We got all kinds of other goodies for you on the Patreon. It's not just an extra episode a week. We got AMAs, we got interviews, we got all kinds of bonus content. We got all the shit that Will and I are too insecure to say unless it's behind a paywall, i.e. the juiciest stuff. We had a recent episode on Dune 2 that was a lot of fun, probably one of our most popular episodes of late.
We also have recent episodes on a movie that was a long time coming, the classic 70s paranoia thriller, The Parallax View. And we recently watched the Dwayne The Rock Johnson remake of Walking Tall. Folks, they gentrified Walking Tall.
And finally, I just want to say, I would encourage everybody to just follow us on Patreon. You don't have to subscribe or give money to follow the podcast there. And it is kind of your one-stop shop for everything. All the non-paywalled stuff is there for your listening pleasure already.
And you get to pretend that we're your friends. That is a Patreon privilege. You get to say to all your friends that we're friends and we can't sue you. By way of getting into our movie on this episode, ooh, I want to tell you about one other French movie I've seen recently made in the decade after 1968. And I bring it up because I've just been seeing these movies kind of by coincidence lately. On the Criterion channel right now, you can watch The Mother and the Whore by Jean Eustache, a 1973 film that for years was unavailable. It only circulated in bootlegs. It's this 3.5-hour film, which, by the way, it's the quickest 3.5 hours you'll ever see. It's a very chatty, very funny movie. It stars Jean-Pierre Léaud, the human embodiment of the French New Wave, the boy from the 400 Blows. Well, he's all grown up now, and he is a fuckboy. he is, to compare him to well-known movie characters, he's like the worst Woody Allen character, you know, you've ever seen.
Someone who the films think is bad, not somebody who's a badly developed character. Okay, gotcha.
That's right. And it's all about his efforts to get engaged in a throuple because he's a sexual libertine, you know? And the whole movie is about these three damaged characters all getting together in the guise of sexual liberation, which is kind of the only liberation we have left. And Eustache's thesis, which could be interpreted as a crypto-reactionary one, is, well, May 1968 failed, the revolution failed. And, you know, a lot of the people who were leading it were basically narcissists who just wanted to get laid. Maybe it would be reductive to call it a good conservative film because it's a very funny movie and it's, you know, more than just a conservative film. And if you're sympathetic to May 1968, I think you could still watch this movie and say, well, you know, they do be like that sometimes. but, you know, I think of this movie, I think of Girard's film, The Lorry. And then, you know, in recent years, there have been certain movies like The French Dispatch, which obviously has a lot to recommend in it, or I haven't seen it, so I cannot confirm that it's bad, although I highly suspect it is. Michel Hazanavicius, the director of The Artist, made a film called Godard Mon Amour.
Just the title is some red flags to me there, but yeah.
It's all about like Godard's radicalization as seen through his relationship at the time. And the thesis of it, as I understand, is, well, he went off to the dark side.
Right.
And, you know, he was sad for the rest of his life. And I don't know, it's funny. Like, I went to see Girard's The Lorry last week, and, you know, there's this feeling there of, yeah, I resonate very strongly with what this is saying in the current moment. But then there are also movies like Godard Mon Amour or The French Dispatch, which again has much to recommend in it, that are sort of almost looking at May 1968 as this like kind of amusing picture postcard from 50 years ago. Like, huh, isn't that funny? So Timothy Chalamet with his manifesto.
You're referring to the chessboard revolution sequence in that, which when I reviewed The French Dispatch for Jacobin, I remember occupied a lot of the review. I mean, it is very interesting. You know, I responded better to that movie than you did. But I mean, if memory serves, I actually think intellectually we had kind of a similar response to it. I was just more glass half full about it. Because, yeah, I mean, that film is sort of, it's taking May 1968 and turning it into this sort of ecstatic myth that's sort of, yeah, without purpose. It's just...
Well, it flattens it into everything else where, like, you know, Wes Anderson takes a lot of the aesthetics of a movie like Masculine Feminine and he reduces everything to aesthetics.
Right, and even just, you know, history is also just completely flattened, you know? It's not May 1968. It's also not May 1968. The student revolutionaries challenge, in the phraseology of the film, 1,000 years of Republican authority. So Wes Anderson's approach to history is the same as his approach to aesthetics, which, I don't know, might be less of a problem in a sequence like this if there was some compelling thesis that the flattening was achieving. And I don't really think there is. Like I said, I enjoyed that film. I was more glass half full about it than Will was. But I do think particularly a sequence like that shows the limits of Anderson's perspective.
Well, seeing Le Camion, one of the responses I had to it was this sort of powerful feeling of like, okay, this very difficult French art movie, what if we actually took seriously what it was saying?
Yeah.
You know, I think of that John Waters review, which is where I first heard about it, where he made the crack about Reyes's pretentiousness to an art form. It's like, okay, but like, what if we actually took seriously what it's saying? And in many quarters in the years since May 1968, I feel like there's this impulse, you know, you see French art films dealing with the aftermath of May 1968, and there's this impulse to kind of not want to engage with it, you know, or to reduce it, or to turn it into something kitschy, or like go, oh, the French with their existentialism and their intellectualism and their obscurantism. And all of that, seeing these movies and thinking about these things, is one reason why I wanted to watch The Devil Probably, by Robert Bresson, which is a different corner of this post-1968 triangle, another movie that is challenging and provocative, and another movie that for years was dismissed or not engaged with in many circles, but which I think is both very of its moment and very eternal. And I think some of the reason for that and some of what's behind that tendency to sort of flatten or dismiss that time has been how bracing depressing and painful these issues can be. So here is a movie that is asking some very difficult, very fundamental questions, does not come to any easy answer about them. And I don't have any easy response to this movie either, but I think it could be an interesting terrain to discuss on.
Ce qui est magnifique, c'est que pour rassurer les gens, il ne suffit ni à l'évidence.
Quelle évidence? On est en plein surnaturel, rien n'est visible.
Qui est-ce donc qui s'amuse à tourner en dérision l'humanité?
Le diable, probablement. Je proclame la destruction. Ouais. Tout le monde peut servir à détruire.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y aura après?
Le diable, probablement.
Well, by way of a friendly qualifier to your table setting just now, Will, about post-68 films, I mean, I do think there are a few separate dimensions that we should keep distinct in our heads, because French filmmakers are grappling with the moment as well. You know, Godard, post-68, is making Tout va bien. Before 68, I think it was just the year before, he makes La Chinoise, which is, you know, an adaptation of Dostoevsky's The Devils, which we covered on an episode way back. That film, which is intensely French, is, you know, perfectly aware that there are these tendencies, you know, amidst all this radical ferment in a place like Paris, there are these tendencies towards fierce and useless anti-empiricism and impenetrable jargon and theory and that kind of thing. And The Devil, probably by Bresson, you know, it's part of this lineage. You know, it is post-1968, but it is also French. There's then another thing which, you know, I think you were referring to, which is this sort of wider tendency outside of France to sort of stereotype, you know, French filmmakers in particular as, yeah, these obscurantists, you know, the French New Wave. Oh, it gave us all these wonderful films that were so much fun to watch, and now all these guys are experimenting with the form, and I don't like it. It's pretentious and French. And, you know, I think largely we know what we think of that. But then, if we're talking about post-1968, the May 1968 moment is not just a French moment. It's, you know, a kind of a universal moment as well. I forget where I encountered, you know, this formulation where you can, you know, you can talk about the 68ers and the 89ers. 1968 has in some ways the same qualities, not just for the French, but outside France as well, as, you know, a year like 1989. It is in retrospect kind of seen as, you know, the end of something or as a zenith of something. So I guess my point, if I have one, is, yeah, we need to keep all these different dimensions and points of entry of post-1968 films and the reception to them in mind. And there's a lot we bring to 1968, I think, whatever our nationality and whatever our ideological perspective.
I think it might actually be useful at this moment to sort of define our terms a little bit. What does 1968, do you think, represent in the French national psyche? I'm asking you this as our podcast resident Parisian expert. You know, what does it represent in France, Europe, the world?
Well, that would sort of be a how much time you got type of question, but I think for our purposes, it's useful to think about May 1968 as the apex of a kind of post-war radical possibility, which crests, and then, you know, the films that we're talking about are all appearing in the wake of that cresting. You know, what does the cresting of the wave mean? What are we left with? Now, Bresson is not as direct a filmmaker as someone like Jean-Luc Godard. So the way I'd like to approach The Devil, probably, and the way I think Will will probably approach it too, is as a terrain. Because this film is thoroughly non-direct, I think it's inevitable that each of us will bring our own ideological baggage to its interpretation. I'll talk a bit later about, you know, the West German filmmaker Fassbinder seems to have had a completely different response to this film than I did, which seems to have been informed very much by his own filmmaking concerns and by the West German experience of the 1970s. In any case, Will and I saw this film some days ago. In the immediate aftermath, I didn't feel like I had much to say about it. I felt that I understood what it was doing, but that because it was so non-direct, my comments on it would be fairly straightforward. But, you know, further to what we were saying before, and making the case for not just doing takes on things, you know, for sitting with them, for thinking about them, for coming back to them, I sat down to type a few notes, and I suddenly found that I had a fair bit to say. So what follows is my rather hastily typed and impressionistic take on Robert Bresson's The Devil, probably, from 1977. The Devil probably is only the second of Robert Bresson's films I've seen, and I can only describe my reaction to it as somewhat complicated. To a considerable extent, I have no sympathy for its main character, who is so disabused of substantive commitment that he makes the Althusser-brained sectarians of Jean-Luc Godard's Tout va bien look politically and intellectually serious. As a piece of cinema, it is typically Bressonian, which is to say, unique and wonderful. But unlike certain French films of the 1960s, it evokes no, or at any rate very little, sense of optimism or possibility. On the other hand, this seems to have been precisely the point. For me, the great achievement of Bresson's film can be found in its depiction of a kind of political and social alienation and disenchantment so thorough and all-encompassing that the only prescription it can muster is one of absolute negation. Negation of any and all substantive political engagement, of attachment to sexual or sensual pleasures, of not only any particular theoretical or normative foundation upon which to ground individual or collective action, Marxism, secular liberalism, French Catholicism, Gaullism, but also of the very notion that foundation of any kind can meaningfully exist. And finally, it films conclusion of total negation and annihilation of the self. In one sense at least, Bresson's lead character Charles, who throughout the movie stumbles into politics, religion, sex, drug use, and psychoanalysis and repudiates each and every one of them, is a singular product of a distinctive time and place, namely the Fifth French Republic after 1968, a society whose constitutive revolutionary horizon had once again seemed to crescendo and then fizzle, leaving behind a generation of youthful radicals who had only the disappointing retreats of the Mitterrand years and the narcotic haze of neoliberalism to look forward to. But there is nonetheless much here with a broader valence. The alienation with mass industry and mass society in The Devil probably might be rooted in the French experience of the 1970s, but people in every industrialized country have experienced it to some degree. Similarly, the film's foreshadowing of an intellectual life consumed by listless anti-foundationalism and abstruse post-structural meanderings might be distinctly French, French intellectuals having made a singular contribution to this theoretical turn, but the phenomenon has to a certain extent become a hallmark of the academy in the age of neoliberalism everywhere. When the prospects of collective agency have withered, the endless theorization of power and language at increasingly inscrutable levels of philosophical abstraction can be a potent soporific. Finally, the existential dilemma captured in the exchange from which the film draws its title. Don't blame the government. No government in the world today can boast it's actually governing. It's the masses who determine events. Question: who is making a mockery out of humanity? Who is leading us by the nose? Answer: the devil, probably. Evokes the core tension of a society still negotiating between the militant secular rationalism of its present and the still latent Christian belief of its past, between the disappointments of mass democratic politics after 1968 and the dethronement of divine revelation after 1789. What, the question here is asking, ultimately motivates evil, and what in fact drives or propels the collective life of a society, ideally away from it but more often in the 20th century, inexorably towards it? To this, the only answer the film can offer comes in a forlorn hybrid of theology and uncertain agnosticism. The devil, probably. Here again, there is something distinctly 1970s and French at play, but I can't help seeing in this exchange a microcosm for the crisis of political ontology in our own time and place. In the 19th century and throughout much of the 20th, human beings could still satiate their desire for transcendence by investing their faith, if not faith of the literal and religious variety, then in its earthly and rational stepchildren. The post-Enlightenment march of reason and progress, the possibility of liberation through technology, the science of dialectical materialism and the inevitability of world revolution, the ineluctable march of globalization and the coming reign of liberal democratic values and universal human rights. In these variously Manichaean and at times Promethean enthusiasms, people in the modern age may have been excessively idealistic about the possibility or pace of social transformation, but they at least possessed tools that made legible their social and political reality, offered a deep account of evil and injustice, and afforded them some place as actors or subjects in a historical trajectory that would eventually see these things drastically reduced or even finally eradicated. Our crisis, like that of Bresson's anti-hero Charles and his contemporary, is that we do not.
So the critic Jay Hoberman once wrote, "You cannot understand cinema without understanding Robert Bresson." And those are very big and intimidating words for a filmmaker who, when he was alive and for a long time after, was considered so cerebral, so restrained, so elliptical, so emotionally austere, so damn artsy, that his work was for freaks and weirdos only.
Well, and I feel slightly guilty now because with that monologue, I've probably contributed to that impression, which I find very strange and perplexing. I mean, you know, like I said, this is only the second Bresson film I've seen, but Bresson is kind of a minimalist. I mean, he's a real auteur. There's a lot of stylization in these films, but it's not like, I mean, just to use an example, because we were talking about before, it's not like Wes Anderson, where there's this meticulous arrangement of everything, or if there is a meticulous arrangement of everything, you don't really notice it in the same way. The films themselves, their plots, I don't know, they're pretty straightforward. And I mean, the sort of affectless philosophical discussions that the characters in a film like The Devil probably have, I mean, I don't think they're impenetrable. I don't really get this impression of Bresson.
Well, I think it's worth pausing to explain his style a little bit, because the films are stylistically unusual in a way that's not always immediately apparent, or at least the specific things they're doing aren't always immediately apparent. He did, of course, make commercial narrative films, you know, that tell stories and have beginning, middles, and ends, but they are rigorously shorn of all the sentimentality, much of the, to use that word again, affect that most conventional narrative films have. He hired non-professional actors, in fact, he called them models, and directed them to drain all emotion out of their performances. Sometimes he would do take after take after take until they were tired, weren't giving anything. And so unlike most filmmakers, he doesn't give you that pleasure of watching an actor overact. His early films had some diegetic music. That's gone by the later ones. I was flipping through his book, Notes on the Cinematographer, earlier today, which is a collection of aphorisms, kind of like Mao's little red book, you know, about his filmmaking practice. And one of them is, "No music, the sounds should be the music." His visual compositions are precise, but also flat. He always used a 50mm lens that he said was the most accurate approximation of the vision of the human eye. Also in Notes on the Cinematographer, one of the many very quotable aphorisms is, "Not beautiful images, but necessary images." He also warns against postcardism, which is a word he uses to describe the very pretty visual style of many of his contemporaries. His editing can also be subtly disorienting. Most movies have an establishing shot in a scene, and in that shot you see the space, you see where the characters are arranged in the space, and then it cuts to, you know, shot, reverse shot, characters talking to each other. Bresson's editing will often be a person walks into frame, they look at something outside of frame, cuts to the thing they're looking at. He doesn't establish the geography of the space. Every shot is an accumulation of the previous shot. It's a different kind of watching. You're seeing one shot build from the last shot, and you have to be conscious of what each shot is. That's something that was not apparent to me the first time I started watching these movies. I had to have it explained to me thanks to the historian David Bordwell in his videos. In practicing such extreme emotional and aesthetic restraint, the idea was to achieve some kind of transcendence. In Film Comment magazine, the critic Kent Jones wrote, "No one has ever made films that are at once so concentrated and so expansive, so precise in their mapping of action, and so careful to allow for a resonance beyond the imagination of almost everyone else who has ever worked in the medium. No other filmmaker has followed everyday existence with such patience, care, and love. The tension between what is seen and what is felt, what is understood and what is undefinable yet present, lies at the core of Bresson's work." Now, in what you were saying earlier, Luke, I was interested in, and I also agree with, not without complication, but I agree with your point that the lead character is not very sympathetic, or at least isn't very sympathetic to you. One of the things that's very challenging about Bresson's films, especially his late films, is in the winnowing away, in the stripping away of all this affect, they truly do not tell you what to think about what you're seeing. Again, there's no music there to guide your emotions. The actors aren't larding up their performances with pathos. This main character, Charles, this disaffected college age youth, long hair, sort of attractive in a twinky kind of way, trying on different, you know, intellectual modes for size and eventually ruling them all not fit. I have a sort of dual reaction to him, you know. Part of it is like, who is this fucking kid? What does this kid know about the world? You know, how dare this kid? This kid's going to opt out of society without even trying. And then there's the other competing part that's like, well, yeah, but is he wrong exactly?
Yeah, so I mean, the plot of The Devil Probably is fairly straightforward, and Will's given us about 80% of it already. We see Charles interact with different aspects of society and culture, different forms of engagement. You know, there's he spends some time in a Catholic church. Doesn't do anything for him.
The Catholic Church is sort of depicted as this like hollowed out building that houses dead dogma. That's not interactive with the moment around it.
Yeah, there are a number of young people we see in this scene, and they find the Catholic liturgy to be mechanical and exhausted. The priest says something like, we want to bring Christianity into modern life. And one of them replies, why not modern life into Christianity?
Can I just interject that this scene was resonant for me in particular as an old lapsed Catholic myself, because I've been to a lot of Catholic masses in my day, and the sermons that the priests give, any of the ones I've ever seen, if they were a newspaper columnist, I wouldn't read them. So many of them have been, you know, you should value your marriage. You know, that's the thesis
right,
of it.
Right.
Or like, you know, we should all be grateful for what we have, like Jesus was,
right.
You know, that sort of thing. And you think of all that's wrong with the world and you hear sermons like that and you get mad.
And of course, the appearance of the Catholic Church in a film like this is not incidental, because France, of course, has its own, you know, deep and complicated relationship with Catholicism and with the Church. Charles, we learn, has apparently been a student at some point, a math student, which I think is quite interesting. Math, I think, in the film is, you know, it's a stand-in for sort of pure reason. Doesn't do anything for him. He has a socially concerned friend called Michelle, and he's kind of in a relationship. You know, he's sleeping with Michelle's girlfriend. Friend. Michelle knows about this and isn't too happy about it, but has kind of made his peace with it.
And Michelle, there's a dichotomy established between him and Charles, where not only is Michelle sort of socially concerned, but he's also more of an aspiring bourgeois than Charles is.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Charles, you know, apparently draws nothing from sex. I was reminded of the sex scene of sorts in Albert Camus' L'Étranger, where there's this very clinical description of the lead character fondling a woman's breasts at the movie theater, and it's completely bloodless and passionless. It's just a description of what happened. Mind you, it's been 15 years since I read that. Everything Charles comes into contact with is like that. There's a scene where charity is being discussed, and to the concept of charity, he simply says, charity degrades the donor as much as the recipient. At the beginning, there's scenes of a political rally of some kind, and someone says, I proclaim destruction. Everyone can destroy. We can sway hundreds of thousands of people with protest signs. Someone else asks, what will be left? To which the reply is, it doesn't matter. Anything would be better than this. So again, further to the point I made before, this is just absolute negation in absolutely everything. There is a discontent and disenchantment with the present, but the only response to it that some of the film's characters, and particularly its lead character, really can muster is just the negation of those things.
And running throughout the film, almost like a chorus, are scenes where the characters watch footage of man-made atrocities around the world. Everything from war and nuclear testing to seal clubbing to pollution to indiscriminate use of harmful pesticides. And across the movie's runtime, which is not that long, it's under 90 minutes, is this accumulation of everywhere you look, something bad is happening.
Yeah, so a lot of that footage comes in these scenes where Michelle is sitting in a room with a projector and playing these little mini documentaries that, yeah, show, you know, atrocities, environmental degradation. There's later a scene in a classroom where this physicist is talking about the science of nuclear fission, and intercut with that is footage of nuclear tests. Both of these things, by the way, are examples of things about this film that are obviously universal but felt distinctly French. The scenes of environmental degradation in the countryside, you know, of kind of tractors spraying pesticides onto crops, that sort of thing, I mean, I believe someone who's an actual historian of France may correct me, but I believe it's a case that it wasn't until the 1950s that the French countryside really saw the advent of kind of industrialized agriculture, which did increase efficiency quite a lot, but also for a lot of people sort of maimed the French countryside, right? People will have to forgive the horrendous generalization I'm about to make, but I mean, in the French identity, I think there's a longstanding dialectic between Paris and the countryside. Paris is, you know, reason, progress, modernity, revolution, you know, the countryside, which, you know, not incidentally, during the French Revolution in the Vendée region saw the biggest anti-republican rebellions. What is the French countryside? It's unchanged and pastoral. It represents tradition, continuity, etc. So what the film is doing with these scenes, definitely universal, but also distinctly French. And I mean, the scene with the physicist talking about the science of nuclear fission, this feels also like it could be a more universal or general comment on the 20th century, on science in the 20th century, but also feels very French. The film is saying, well, look, we have this supposedly emancipatory thing called reason. And yeah, it allows us to understand how atoms work and you know, have nuclear fission. But then, you know, we're seeing these nuclear tests and it's like, okay, well, it also allows us to kill like massive numbers of people and destroy the earth in an instant.
This is a complete digression, but did I ever tell you when I was working at a job in the communications sector, probably about a decade ago, I had cause to interview a noted liberal politician, Ken Dryden, who was
probably a little more famous. I mean, I do like his literary output. He's probably a little more famous as a hockey player.
He was doing a course at a well-known downtown university where it was dime store Steven Pinker shit. As I was interviewing him, he was saying things like, you know, people will tell you that the world's never been in a worse state than it's ever been, but look at all these buildings. look at the great technology.
Have you seen the condos on Bay Street that have been put up there?
I mean, the garbage gets collected every week. I mean, isn't that incredible? And that discussion has never left my mind. Yeah. And I've been thinking about it a lot in light of the current situation in Gaza, where it's like, yeah, you know, we do have buildings. And what has it gotten us?
Right. Just imagining, you know, Professor Pangloss walking through the ruins of Hiroshima and being like, do you see all the condos that have gone up in Toronto in the last 15 years?
Yeah. If you bomb out a whole city, you can really do some expensive redevelopment there.
Now, Charles has a number of other interactions. Possibly my favorite scene in the movie was right near the end where he goes to the psychoanalyst. There's a very strange touch in this scene. Maybe I just don't have the proper context for this, but I like how at the end, you know, Charles basically pays him by just like taking some coins out of his pocket and just putting them in a little tip jar on the guy's desk. I'm not going to try to recapitulate this scene. The exchanges in it are, you know, much like those in other scenes of the movie. And the only takeaway for Charles is further self-abnegation. So having brushed up against all of these, you know, social and cultural and political and sensual things, the last resort is to dive into the self and try to find some kind of foundation or solace there. And he can't do that either. So towards the end of the movie, he goes to a friend of his and says, here, I'll give you all of this money. I'm not going to tell you what it's for until a little bit later, but, you know, come out with me. The two of them go to a cafe. They have some whiskey or something.
Some cognac, specifically.
Oh, yeah, specifically cognac.
And can I just say, you know, this is a little bit of Canadian provincialism here, but I look at a scene like this and, you know, even in this movie, it's like, God, look at these cool French people having their cognac in the outdoor cafe.
Yeah,
talking about philosophy.
The movie is doing its utmost to make Paris, like the scenes of the Paris metro, it looks like such shit. Like you think.
And to me, it still looks great.
And it looks amazing. Yeah. And yeah. Yeah, it's like it's the 70s, and I guess like the, you know, French welfare state was big enough that like, yeah, you go to a psychoanalyst and instead of being like 7,000 francs an hour or whatever it is now, you just like, I don't know, tip them a few in the jar. It's voluntary.
But yeah, they have some cognac, and Charles also hears a little snatch of Mozart coming from one of the balconies. And there's the brief thought of, well, will one hear Mozart after death? Which, of course, this put me in mind of the last scene of Chaplin's Monsieur Verdu, which I'm sure Bresson would have been familiar with. Another apocalyptic movie that after about 30 minutes at the end of just, again, complete abnegation, on the way to the guillotine, Verdu says, wait, I will have some rum. I've never had rum. And he has that taste of it. He sort of gives a little face like, And then he goes off to die.
Here. What's that? Rum? No, thank you. Just a moment. I've never tasted rum.
And that is Chaplin's one acknowledgement in that movie of, well, you know, there is rum. You know, you might want to stay alive for the rum. And in this movie, you know, Bresson gives you the acknowledgement of, well, hey, there's the cognac, and you probably won't hear Mozart after you die.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that is probably as, you know, direct as the film gets. Direct and life-affirming, to use a cliched phrase, as the film gets. I mean, I do think, you know, if we're approaching it as a terrain, I mean, I would like to say a little bit in defense of Michel, because it seems that in Michel, I mean, you know, he does seem like he's a little bit predictable in his ways. He's not as probing as Charles, but he is socially concerned. You know, when I see Michel's little documentaries showing environmental degradation and atrocities, there's a type of negation that I'm thinking about, and it's the negation of those things that are bad. It's the same reaction I have when I'm reading Foucault, and he's just talking, you know, you read Discipline and Punish, and he's laying out this detailed history of all this ugly, horrendous, oppressive, violent mechanisms of discipline and punishment. Public executions, prisons, panopticons, etc. But then there's no moment where he then says, yeah, okay, and maybe we should get rid of these things. I mean, I had a professor who referred to that aspect of Foucauldian thinking as, you know, crypto-normative. Like, it's implicit in this what you should do about it, but, you know, he doesn't seem to feel that way. For him, power has become something so diffuse that, I don't know, the earlier possibilities offered by a moment like 1968 or 1789 or 1794, nothing like that's really available to you.
Well, the good thing about having some sort of a theoretical framework for your beliefs, some sort of ideology to fall back on, is no matter how many political defeats you suffer, no matter how often you lose, your basic understanding of the world and knowledge of who the enemies are remains the same. Certainly, it can be frustrating and even despair-inducing to see how omnipresent power is and the many ways that it's figured out how to co-opt revolution and dissent. Nevertheless, yeah, I mean, probably goes without saying that killing yourself, while understandable, doesn't really accomplish anything. And in the meantime, there is Mozart music to listen to. I actually would have appreciated if Ken Dryden had said that to me. I wish he had said, people say the world is so bad, but have you seen the Marvel movies? They're really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree with all of that, although I keep thinking about the title of this film and what it conjures for me. And as much as I would like to not identify with the sentiment being conveyed there, you know, from whence cometh evil, well, the devil probably, like, I don't know. It does resonate in many ways. I mean, sure, I can look at evil and injustice in the world and think, well, the solution to those things consists in their negation. I can look at poverty and I can tell you that the economic system we live under is the thing that's causing it and that there are various things we can do to rectify it. Or I can look at the horrors being inflicted on the people of Gaza, and I can tell you that they're in some way a product of the logic of empire, and, you know, some kind of historical foundation can be given for them, etc., etc. But I do not feel equipped as, I don't know, somebody who is my equivalent in, say, 1936 perhaps could, or someone in the mid-1960s. I think what I was really trying to get at in my response to the film off the top of our discussion was that I think even those of us who operate on the basis of relatively structured and articulated ideological conviction. I mean, I can't speak for others, but there are horrors in the 20th century, injustices that I look at. And if you really pushed me on, you know, where does this come from? I don't have anything that approaches perhaps the Christian answer. You know, we're fallen creatures. Yeah, it comes from the devil. And I don't have anything that approaches the secular equivalence to that either. You know, I'm not sitting here feeling confident that we're 10 years away from the overthrow of our economic system. Or that, yeah, we're going to invent some new way of generating power that's going to stop the climate crisis in its tracks and have us all living in a utopia and setting up Martian colonies within 15 or 20 years. I don't have anything like that. So, yeah, if you pushed me on it, I might frankly answer that the culprit is the devil, probably. Because on some real and fundamental level, I don't know.
Je proclame la destruction.
Ouais!
I've had a very macroscopic take on this film, and Will has very usefully grounded the discussion a little more in the markings of Bresson's actual cinema and his style. I did just want to say a few things about that, because, I mean, it really is incredible. And I'll just reiterate what I said before. I don't really understand the reception that you were relaying, Will, of Bresson's films as, I don't know, yeah, unbearably French and impenetrable and highbrow and art filmy. Like,
I agree with you. I will also say, though, when you think about some of the themes we've been discussing on this episode, is life worth living? If there's no possibility for political change, should we go on?
Yeah, what if there isn't an afterlife, you know? Yeah.
Pretty heavy stuff.
Anyway, Bresson is a stylist. Look, he takes sound incredibly seriously, and he deploys it very effectively, as Will's already said. It has a sensual and tactile quality in this film, and in A Man Escaped, the other of his films I've seen. You hear bags ruffling, a sound of a keyboard being opened and closed, and you feel them in your body.
I've got notes on the cinematographer in front of me here right now, which everyone should read. It's a lot of fun. Here are some of his ideas, just little aphorisms here. On true and false, the mixture of true and false yields falsity, photographed theater on cinema. The false, when it is homogeneous, can yield truth, theater. In a mixture of true and false, the true brings out the false. The false hinders belief in the true. An actor simulating fear of shipwreck on the deck of a real ship, battered by a real storm, we believe neither in the actor, nor in the ship, nor in the storm. I mean, that intellectual configuration he's thinking there, like, I love it.
That's so
good. It makes a lot of sense when you're reading it. It makes sense in his films. But, you know, then I think of all those movies with big, hammy Al Pacino performances that do feel true when you're watching them, you know? So ultimately, every director creates their own reality.
I don't even remember where this particular scene in The Devil probably fit in the plot, but there's a scene where there's some youths in the countryside, and I don't know, they're fishing, and some police come and are fucking them up or kicking them out or whatever. And someone's fishing, catches a fish. Someone exclaims, he caught a live fish. And for some reason, what we're seeing on the screen at this moment is just a row of youths and not even their faces, just a shot of their legs and their feet while the line's being delivered. I saw that and I made a point to take note of it because in that moment, what I was thinking was, God, it's so nice to just be exposed to a different kind of visual grammar. Like, everything today looks exactly the same, even when it's well done.
I was mentioning Bresson's editing style earlier on, the sort of way that images accumulate from other images rather than, you know, revealing everything in a tableau and then cutting within that. Here's another little good bit from his book. An image must be transformed by contact with other images, as is a color by contact with other colors. A blue is not the same blue beside a green, a yellow, a red. No art without transformation. Don't you love that?
Oh, man. Now, look, we've said a lot about our responses to this film. I did find a book called Neither God Nor Master, Robert Bresson and Radical Politics by Brian Price. This was published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2011. I'd like to get my hands on a copy. Chapter 6 is called The Agony of Ideas, The Devil Probably, and Revolutionary Discourse. And it begins with an exchange that took place at the 1977 Berlin Film Festival in response to the film. Fassbinder was on the jury, and he was speaking in response to the film. So Christian Brad Thompson asks, what are the problems raised in Bresson's film? Are they rejecting all political forms? Fassbinder replies, yes, rejecting every commitment, because commitment for the film's young characters, whom he seems to understand so well, is mainly an escape into occupation, in scare quotes, which keeps that commitment alive. An escape from the awareness that everything goes on regardless of you and your commitment. Fassbinder offered this response to The Devil Probably at the 1977 Berlin Film Festival where he sat on the jury. Fassbinder threatened to leave the jury unless his support for the film, which was entirely unappreciated by his colleagues, was made public. The cool reception of Bresson's film in Berlin and Fassbinder's subsequent support for it is not so surprising. The Devil Probably is a fierce indictment of the repressive tactics of the state, of its destruction of the environment, and its close monitoring of youth culture, which was not lost on the French press, where worries over the film's supposed call to suicide were followed by calls for censorship. Fassbinder's response to The Devil Probably suggests the significance of The Devil Probably to questions about the efficacy of revolution and left-wing terrorism raging through Europe in the mid to late 1970s. Revelatory as Fassbender's response to the film is, however, it is also a selective one. In his initial remarks, Fassbender valorizes youth culture as this jewel of political commitment. Commitment to a particular political idea is, Fassbender suggests, merely an illusion, a way of ignoring the monolithic character of state power. However, an unreflective commitment to an idea, as the third generation suggests, leaves one even more vulnerable to the system one desires to overthrow. What Fassbender admired most about The Devil probably is the idea Bresson raises about the rejection of all social and political commitments as the true measure of freedom. So, like, this is a long chapter, but I'm very interested in this response to the film by Fassbender, because the difference between how I responded to it and how he responded to it, to me, Will, is kind of like our respective responses to the French Dispatch, where I don't feel like I intellectually disagree with what Fassbender seems to be finding in the film. As Price puts it, you know, he valorizes youth culture as a jewel of political commitment. Fassbender does, and he finds that in Bresson's film, but he sees something constructive in it that I don't necessarily. There's a certain optimism he finds in it. And I have nothing profound to say about this, except that I think it's very interesting.
You know, without knowing too much about Fassbender's perspective, I would imagine that being a youngish man in Germany in the 1970s probably informed it. Perhaps with him and his generational coevals, there was a skepticism of ideological attachment, given what had happened in Germany in recent history. I don't think he's wrong to have that reaction exactly, because, again, Bresson takes away any of the cinematic niceties that would instruct you in how to react. And I would speculate that Bresson has affection for the central character and sympathy for him, given that he made a movie around him. But, you know, we see footage throughout the movie again and again of atrocities in the world. And if the movie has a central question, it seems to be, given all this, why go on living? And if the main character's reaction is, there's no reason to, it's hard for me to find optimism in that decision. You know, it's the main character admitting defeat, which, again, I can sympathize with, but I don't see optimism.
Yeah, admitting defeat is something I understand, but it's also something I don't want to do.